This is Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. Coming up later on our program, we do something I thought we'd never do. We'll reference Twilight, and I promise you it will be brief. We're chatting with the Native American Artist Collective, the 1491s, later in the hour. Also, journalist and Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson joins us for our Great Lakes Month in Review segment. But first, a federal judge in Detroit will hear opening arguments today on a case that could potentially overturn Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage. In 2012, two lesbian nurses sued Governor Rick Snyder and Attorney General Bill Schuette. The couple is raising three special needs children, but they cannot legally adopt them unless they are married. Michigan's gay marriage ban has been in force for almost a decade, but the couple's attorney, Dana Nessel, argued on the WXYZ-TV program Spotlight that Michigan's constitutional amendment violates the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause.
We have always held true to the belief that constitutional rights are fundamental. They're not something that the public ought to be voting on.
Earlier, I spoke with Rick Pluta, the State House Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. He's been following the case. He started our conversation by breaking down the details.
April DeBoer and Jane Rouse are a same-sex couple. They are both nurses, and they've been together about a decade. And during their time together, they have individually, one adopted two and one adopted one, individually adopted three special needs children that they are, however, raising together. And this originally started out as an adoption rights case that they said, we want to be able to jointly adopt these children so that if something should happen to one of us, that they can be taken care of by the other. If a divorce or a breakup occurs, then that they still have rights to make sure that both parents are doing the things that they're supposed to do, just like, you know, Michigan divorce laws require of other parents. And when they took their case to federal law saying that their children were being denied due process. And that's kind of an important distinction here. They say that this is not as much about their rights to be married, although that has now become part of the case, but this is about their children's rights to be protected just like any other children being raised in a household by two parents. Their children's rights to, you know, qualify for dual insurance coverage and all kinds of other benefits that go along with it. And so they brought their case challenging Michigan's adoption laws to federal court, and the judge, Bernard Friedman, said, you know, I don't think you get to the root of the question unless you actually go and challenge Michigan's same-sex marriage ban, the marriage amendment to the Michigan Constitution that was approved 10 years ago in November.
So research will be a large part of the arguments that are going to take place.
There is a lot of research out there. A lot of it is foundation-driven by parties that have a particular interest in how the case is resolved. The Attorney General's office, Bill Schuette's office, will present research from basically the conservative side saying that there is plenty of evidence that shows that the optimal situation for children is to be raised in a household by biological parents, one man, one woman, who are married to each other. And then the attorneys for April DeBoer and Jane Rouse will challenge that and try to debunk it and say, really, there's very little evidence that shows that there's any detrimental effect for children being raised in same-sex households. And what they're doing is actually folding in a lot of other ancillary situations, like, you know, when a couple breaks up, what are the effects of divorce? A stable home is good for children, but that home can be led by a same-sex couple or a man and a woman. And so that's where all of that is. So, you know, a lot of this is going to be fought out based on that. And then once the judge makes a decision on that and whether or not the state has a compelling interest in protecting, you know, traditional one man, one woman marriage for the sake of the children, he's also got to get to the question of whether marriage is a fundamental right. that is protected by the U.S. Constitution. And then if it's a fundamental right, then
it overturns the ban from 2004.
Well, it also it can't be voted on. And so in your introduction, that is what Dana Nessel, the attorney for Jane Rouse and April DeBoer, was talking about, that if marriage is a fundamental right, then it can't be voted on by the people. The people don't get to decide whether this group of people can get married or not. It's just their right to, and it cannot be taken away.
In the last 8 months, there's been a lot of legal activity. We kind of went over this, at least with the Supreme Court. But also because of their decline to hear the case on California, there's been several federal judges that have struck down same-sex marriage bans in five different states
yeah.
at this point. So what happens if Michigan joins these other states?
Well, yeah, it's kind of funny that this summer, because Judge Friedman had seemed to be on a path to making a pretty quick decision, you know, a lot of us were looking at this and thinking that Michigan might be the state that actually brings a full throttle frontal challenge to, you know, bans on same-sex marriage to the United States Supreme Court. Now it seems like there are these, you know, five cases, you know, maybe even more, that are in the pipeline that are going to be challenged before appellate courts that might make it there sooner. The distinction for Michigan might be just all the work that Judge Friedman is trying to create surrounding the research regarding, mm-hmm. you know, what it's like for children raised in same-sex households, which might make it part of a compelling case, you know, going further up the ladder. I mean, no matter what, we do know that however Judge Friedman rules, you know, once this is over, you know, probably sometime next week, the trial will be over sometime next week. We don't know how long it'll take for the judge to set forth an opinion. But no matter, you know, what Judge Friedman rules, that it will most likely be challenged before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals and, you know, then up the ladder, unless, you know, something happens at a higher level that renders those questions moot.
You've already addressed long term that this is probably going to continue to be in courts for a while, but mm-hmm. short term, say Friedman, he strikes down the marriage ban for Michigan, what happens?
Well, if Judge Friedman does in fact strike down the marriage ban and say that the state does not have a compelling interest in regulating marriage in that particular way, that it is a fundamental right, something like that, then, you know, really whichever side loses will file an appeal and will, you know, seek some type of stay of the judge's decision. If the judge strikes down the ban on same-sex marriage, certainly you know, that the attorney general would go ahead and say, but, you know, please delay that while we file an appeal with the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And if Judge Friedman says no to that, then he would go to the Sixth Circuit and ask the Sixth Circuit to then stay it, which would be, you know, a pretty, you know, standard operating procedure, maintain the status quo while we sort through these questions. But, you know, another possibility is that Judge Friedman could also, you know, strike down Michigan's adoption laws and say, and I'm not going to, you know, stay that, and say that, you know, either way, we are going to allow you to jointly adopt these children and, you know, make sure that they get all the benefits that go along with that.
So the trial will be done, or the arguments will be heard by the end of this week?
That the trial is scheduled to begin this morning, and the judge has allotted basically to keep it going through the end of next week. That is not a hard timeline. That there's a list right now. The last one I saw was 23 witnesses. We don't know if all of those witnesses are, most of them are experts, academics of some type. Mm-hmm. We don't know if all of those witnesses are going to be called. We don't know how long they're going to testify. We don't know how long cross-examination is going to take. So the length of the trial is a moving
target.
Could
be going on and on and on for a while. Rick Bluta is the State House Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's so great to be here with you, Emmanuel.
This is Current State. I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. Last week, an Ingham County judge ordered Coastguard Lotto, a 21-year-old Lansing resident, to be held in the state's psychiatric hospital in Kalamazoo for up to 15 months or until he can be deemed competent to stand trial for a felony lying to police charge. Lotto's story, which has been chronicled by the Lansing State Journal's Kevin Grasha, began last June when he was wrongly identified as a murder suspect. After giving a false confession under police interrogation, the Sudanese refugee was charged with murder, but the charges were eventually dropped. However, he was then subsequently charged with a felony for providing false statements to police. Though he was not diagnosed with schizophrenia at the time of his false confession, Lotto has since received the diagnosis twice and been deemed incompetent to stand trial. The case has drawn some public criticism of Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings III. There is an online petition asking that Dunnings drop the charges, and last week the Lansing State Journal wrote a scathing editorial with the headline, "Why Persecute an Innocent Mentally Ill Man?" Joining me now is one of those calling for the charges against Mr. Lotto to be dropped. James Schonkweiler was the executive director of the Prosecuting Attorneys Association of Michigan for 27 years. He's been following the case. James, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So what about this case caused you to feel the need to speak out?
I was contacted by community organizers who were concerned about the case and asked to get involved and to come to the hearing that was held by Judge DeLuca to learn more about the facts of the case, which were upsetting, to say the least, to the people who contacted me.
You've read the confession. What's your takeaway from that confession?
I think any reading of the confession leaves the reader recognizing that Lotto was confused, was frightened. He comes, of course, from his earlier part of his life was in Sudan. English is his second language. He's used to being afraid of authorities and afraid of police. There's places in the transcript where it looks like he's worried they're going to ask him about something else he may have done that wasn't right. And he's preparing what he's saying to deal with that. He doesn't understand the questions. And the officers don't understand his answers. In many cases, they have to be repeated. He asks for a lawyer several times. The police sort of slid through that and went on with their questioning, although they certainly treated him gently. But whether the questioning should have stopped on the police initiative is a question I think we need to consider at some point. At one point, he seems to be typical of mentally ill people who are being interrogated under pressure. He felt like he had to say something. He felt like he had to acknowledge that he was at fault in some way. And so he made what sounded like admissions and then almost immediately said no. And then he later, at the end of the interrogation, he said, "I didn't shoot no one," which was what the issue was. I don't think he realized what the issue was when he first sat down. So because attorneys were not appointed, although the officers stated that one would be appointed, and he'd asked, but there was never any action taken on it. I don't think the confession is admissible.
And I mean, but according to the felony lying to police law, which has been in place since 2012, he did technically break the law, no?
I think so. If you follow what he was doing, what he was saying, what he was being asked, there were technical violations, which he then tried to correct.
Why should that be overlooked? I mean, there's clearly confusion going on in this. Do you think that felony lying to police law should stand in this case?
The circumstances surrounding this are what make my answer no. He shouldn't be held. think where to start here, but he was arrested out of his home, taken down to the police department, didn't know exactly why or what they were asking him or for what purpose. He made statements that were confusing and self-contradictory. And I think that on the substance, the prosecutor's job, if I can pause just to speak a little bit to that, is the insulation between the hard, cold letters of the law and actual fact situations. And sometimes charges make sense, but what particular charge has to be chosen, again, the prosecutor's job. Or the prosecutor has discretion to not charge because justice simply isn't being done or wouldn't be done by charges against this offender in this case. And I think that's the situation that if I were still in prosecution and this case came before me, I think I would say the public is not being served by charges against this man who hardly knew why he was being questioned.
The prosecutor in this case, Stuart Dunning, said that there's nothing to say that he was mentally ill at the time of the false confession. And in fact, he wasn't diagnosed until October or November later. Why doesn't this matter, in your view?
That we don't have that information at the time. Well, the mentally ill component of the prosecutor's exercise of his or her discretion is important, but it's not the only thing. If he were mentally ill and known, that was known at the time of the prosecutor's charging decision. Yes, it's a major factor. But in this case, the other things I mentioned, the content of the conversation with the police themselves leads the reader to state, this young man doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know what he's answering to. Doesn't appear at times to understand the questions. And when he made a statement at one point that he shot someone, then the interrogation continued from that point. He didn't know where it happened. He didn't know whether it was a rifle or a handgun. Again, from the conversation as a whole, you can't help but come to the conclusion that he didn't really know what he was saying.
What was going on? What if Koskar is deemed competent to stand trial, but is then found not to be criminally responsible by the prosecutor and the charges are dropped? What happens?
He's free. That's the first and most exciting thing that happens to him. I think I haven't heard anyone connected to the case legally or discussing it, including his present counsel. Who feels other than the case would be easily won once it gets to a trial and you get past the competency to stand trial barrier, that the case will be won quickly, easily. No jury, no judge is going to convict this young man based on this rambling narrative of question and answer that was as confusing as it was.
James Schankweiler is the former executive director of the Prosecuting Attorneys Association of Michigan. James, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And on the phone to help us understand what goes into the process of making someone competent to stand trial is Dr. Eric Neal. He's a psychiatrist at the state's Center for Forensic Psychiatry. Welcome to the program, Dr. Neal.
Thank you very much.
So when a defendant is deemed not competent to stand trial and the judge orders them to the state psychiatric hospital to restore competency, what does that actually mean? I mean, what is the working definition of being competent?
Sure. Well, just to back up quickly, you know, the Center for Forensic Psychiatry is a pretty specialized facility in the state of Michigan. We, you know, every state does it differently, but we have a very centralized system to evaluate this. Anybody in the state of Michigan that's concerned through the court, either attorney can do it, prosecutor, the defense attorney, or even the judge can raise issues of competency. And that's at the core of making sure that anybody has a fair trial. What would happen at that point is they would be sent to our facility for an evaluation on competency. We would evaluate them, and we would create an opinion and provide that to court. The court would have a hearing on which both sides would have a chance to do a direct and cross, and then also an independent medical evaluation can be conducted if requested. And then the court would have an opportunity to make an opinion on if that person was indeed incompetent or not. If they do find that person to be incompetent, what they'll do is they'll commit them on a treatment order for restoration to competency. That doesn't have to be at our facility, although most often it is. And what will happen then is they will be given a treatment order up to a third of the sentence. So if it's a minor crime, it's only a third of that time, up to a maximum, no matter what the charge is, of 15 months. So they would be admitted to our facility, because our facility has two parts. It has the evaluation unit, but then we also have a 220-bed forensic hospital. And we treat either people who are incompetent to stand trial or who have been found not guilty by reason of insanity. Those are the only two people that we treat in this facility.
So when you talk about treatment, I mean, what do you mean? What are some of the procedures?
Sure. Well, just to kind of give you a perspective, every year we do, because we do all of them for the state of Michigan, we do about 1,900 incompetent to stand trial evaluations. About 18% of those people are found incompetent to stand trial and then will be sent for treatment. The vast majority of those people turn out to be schizophrenics or bipolar disorder people who have had some difficulty with psychosis, and the majority of them are off of medications at the time of the evaluation. And particularly for the schizophrenics, some of the problems that come and have direct relation to competencies is that a lot of times schizophrenics, when ill and off of medications, have delusions. So in other words, they have false beliefs not based on reality. And a lot of times they can be very paranoid about the court proceedings and may not cooperate with their lawyer because of that. Or because of their illness, they can have disorganized thinking and they can become incredibly confused and they are not able to really understand the nature of proceedings against them or assist their attorney. We are often very successful. We have usually our turnaround rate for people who are admitted for incompetent to stand trial. On average, we're able to restore them to competency within 3 to 4 months and then return them to the trial, mostly through medication. However, we do provide a lot of psychoeducation, and we do individual or group therapy. So it would depend on the person. But again, most of the time, these are people who have a psychotic disorder, who are actively psychotic off of medications. We restore them by reducing that psychosis.
Are people allowed to refuse medication?
Most of the time, they don't. Obviously, that there's a subset. You know, I think that most of the time we spend, you know, we're a hospital, we're physicians. You know, we don't really like to force medications. We will if there's imminent risk, but we spend most of our time trying to educate the person on the benefits of having that medication. They often have been in jail for some period of time, and that issue is they've already been on some medication, maybe not maximized and maybe not as effective as it can be. So we usually don't have that problem, but yes, it is a treatment order. As for the requirement to restore them to competency, if we have to, we can provide medication against their will, although that's not the commonplace. And there are practical difficulties because not every medication can be forced upon a person, per se. So that's not as practical as one would think. But most of the time, that's not a problem, although it's within the treatment order to have that happen.
What about visitors? I know in this case in particular, there's concern about Coast Guard refugee being away from his family. Are people often allowed to have visitors?
Oh, yes. You know, there's several levels of that. We're a high-secure facility. We're the highest secured psychiatric hospital in the state of Michigan. So there's levels of that, but we have regular visits with people that have, you know, just like you would imagine in some other high-secure facilities with a barrier between them. But then we could also set up barrier-free visits, and so there's different levels of that, but absolutely. You know, we're a hospital. We want to encourage people's connection with their family and their resources in the community.
Dr. Eric Neal is a psychiatrist at the State Center for Forensic Psychiatry. Dr. Neal, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. This is Current State. At the end of each month, we check in Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson for updates on environmental stories from around the basin. For today's Great Lakes Month in Review, we're focusing on Governor Snyder's environmental efforts and algae blooms. Gary Wilson, welcome to Current State.
Hey, Emmanuel. Good morning, and good to have you behind the mic on a weekday.
Yeah, this is a rare occasion for me.
And a good one.
Yeah, thank you. All right, so let's start with Governor Snyder. In his budget proposal, he featured some Great Lakes-centric items, but before we assess this year's proposals, let's take a look back a little bit about what Snyder has done in the past for the Great Lakes in relation to budgets.
Sure, Emmanuel. Governor Snyder, he's coming to this budget proposal, which is about $14 million, mostly to combat invasive species, in the last year of his term. And, you know, those of us that track these things over time, Michigan is the Great Lakes state. Governor Snyder is, the leader of the Great Lakes state. You guys are surrounded by water. So in the first 3 years, he was, so strangely on the sidelines. I think everybody in the community was willing to give him a pass for the first year. He inherited a lot of problems, and he had a lot of things on his plate, especially with budget issues. So for the first year, people were kind of go, okay, where are the Great Lakes? And he's not doing much. He's not saying much. Okay, he'll get to it. We know he will. But when I got into year two, and especially year three, there really wasn't much from him about the Great Lakes. Then here we go into his last year. And now he's starting to focus on them a little bit. So there's a thought out there that he's been late to the party.
Yeah, what did he propose this year? Let's talk a little bit about the funding projects for the Great Lakes that Snyder proposed in his State of the State and budget addresses.
Sure. In the State of the State, he quickly touched on the need to focus on invasive species of all types, aquatic and otherwise. But he didn't really provide a lot of detail, except that he would be proposing money for his budget address, which he did a week or so later. And in that address, he's proposing $14 million to combat invasive species, trying to get ahead of the curve a little bit. I think what the state has done mostly is react, and once you start reacting to invasive species, it's really too late. You're fighting and losing battle. So he wanted to get a little bit on the front side related to prevention, and he's proposed $14 million for that. It's all good, but I equate it to brushing your teeth in the morning. You need to do that, but it's not a big deal.
So the proposal did focus on invasive species, but he didn't address the most pressing invasive species, many would argue, for the Great Lakes region, which is Asian carp. He didn't mention the Army Corps study at all. What do you make of that?
Well, that's perplexing to me, and it's frustrating. Like I said, he is the governor of the Great Lakes State, and he also has a leadership position in the region with the Council of Great Lakes Governors. He and Governor Quinn from Illinois are the co-chairs of that organization. This Army Corps study, which we've talked about a number of times, is one of the biggest things to happen related to invasive species ever. I just think that he's been silent on it. I think that as the governor of the Great Lakes State, he should be out there saying something, whether he's for physical separation, against it, even if he's neutral, wants to study it more, he should be taking a position. Governor Quinn from Illinois last year, he kind of softly came out for physical separation, saying it was the ultimate solution. So even if Governor Snyder said something now, he wouldn't be on the cutting edge. And he's, Governor Quinn provided him a little bit of political cover. So being on the sidelines now with this big issue facing the region and his state, it seems he could do better.
Another big issue facing the entire Great Lakes region is algae blooms. So first, just a reminder, what is an algae bloom and how do they impact the Great Lakes?
Well, algae blooms are caused by the nutrient runoff from the tributaries into the Great Lakes. Lake Erie is the biggest problem. The nutrient runoff is phosphorus, nitrogen, and that mostly comes from agriculture runoff. There are other ways that it gets into the lake. Sewage discharge is a big one with the Detroit River's outflow into Lake Erie. And also in the Great Lakes Bay, Saginaw Bay, they've got significant algae problems, but it's mostly caused by agricultural runoff. It's a big problem. There's a dead zone in Lake Erie that's caused by harmful algae blooms. If you go to the beach in the summertime, you take your kids, you take your dog. The kids can't swim because they could get sick. Dogs love to run in water. They run in the water. They drink the water. They can get sick. So it's a big problem. It has been one for years.
So it's been a problem for years, but what types of programs have been in place or created to try and resolve this issue?
They're mostly voluntary programs asking the farmers to use best management practices. The EPA is, it's got direct responsibility for this, and under the Clean Water Act, they've got authority. But they've really been fairly soft. They propose a lot of studies. They spend a lot of money on study, and they've left it to the states to use voluntary measures, propose voluntary measures to get the farmers to comply. Voluntary measures, they're good, but any place where voluntary measures have been used, and I think the Chesapeake Bay is the prime example, voluntary measures have never been successful. And that even led one of our environmental groups, the Natural Resources Defense Council, Ann Alexander writes a blog there, and they've been tracking this, and they've been involved with the EPA for years. She says this kumbaya approach of just voluntary measures, let's hold hands and collaborate, it won't work, and it's time for the EPA and the states to step up and do more.
Well, we'll be keeping our eye on that. Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes commentator and journalist. Gary, thanks for your time.
Always good to be with you, Emmanuel. Thank you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org or on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Tomorrow, Wednesday, is the second anniversary of the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. George Zimmerman shot the unarmed teenager while on a neighborhood watch patrol. Claiming self-defense under Florida's controversial Stand Your Ground law, Zimmerman was ultimately acquitted of second-degree murder and manslaughter charges. Attorney Benjamin Crump has represented the interest of Martin's family. He has a speaking engagement tonight in Lansing. Current State's Scott Pohl recently spoke with Benjamin, and he's here with more. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Benjamin Crump will give a talk at 6 p.m. tonight called Justice in America, Trayvon Martin, Race, and the Law at Cooley Law School. He says Martin's family is doing as well as can be expected.
His mother, Sabrina Tracy, his father, have chose to have the annual Trayvon Remembrance Weekend in conjunction with his birthday on February 5th to celebrate his life and not recognize his tragic end. And what they have done is something so amazing, Scott. They have a peace walk. The Trayvon Martin Annual Peace Walk, where they walk with thousands of teenagers and young people and tell them they have the right to walk in peace. And then at the end of the peace walk, they have celebrities and athletes and police officers and community leaders come and have a peace talk about their ways to settle conflicts without having to use guns and use violence, because they really want to try to make a difference as a legacy to Trayvon, that you have no more Trayvon Martins and that our children do get to live to be 18 and become adults. It was held in Miami, Florida. They had an incredible Trayvon Martin Foundation dinner on that Sunday night, but the peace walk was incredible. He would have been 19 years old this year.
Your talk for the Cooley Law School Black Law Student Association is called Justice in America, Trayvon Martin, Race, and the Law. Can you give me a preview of the sorts of things you'll talk about?
Certainly. I'll talk to the next generation of lawyers, trying to encourage them to understand that they have an obligation to try to make sure that every American get equal justice, especially the least to be, that they got to do better than we have done. I believe they're going to do better. They are our future. And the fact that these laws like Stand Your Ground, which legalize murder and so disproportionately affect the community that many of them have come from, that they have to answer the bell by making a difference, by changing these laws, by fighting in the courtrooms to protect our children and our families, but also to make sure that equal justice is done in these cases, I think so much it is about trying to let the people in every community know that they are an American and that they have every right to justice and protection like any other American. And we got to force America to be America for everybody.
Are American law schools doing enough to attract and train African-American attorneys? And what's the status of African-American opportunities in the law once a student graduates from law school?
Well, I think every industry, every profession now is becoming more and more challenging. I think law is no exception. You got to really work hard to achieve your dream and desire if you want to be a lawyer. I think the law schools had been better in the past. You remember they had all these Michigan anti-affirmative action lawsuits and stuff. I think it has had a chilling effect on law schools recruiting minorities because they argued unsuccessfully in principle with the Supreme Court. However, it had an effect when Michigan Law School was sued and University of Texas was sued, where the school said, well, we don't want to get hit well for a quota lawsuit. So they, I think in some regards, were not as aggressive in recruiting black professional graduate students. And so that has had a chilling effect. But like every other obstacle, we overcome, and we just have to continue to be excellent. There's no substitute for excellence, and I don't believe there's no denying excellence. So when I talk to those young minds at Cooley Law School, I'm going to remind them that as long as you are excellent, you will not be denied. Make your goal to be excellent in whatever you do. It's as Dr. Martin Luther King said, if you are called on this earth to sweep streets, well, you sweep the streets as Michelangelo painted, as Shakespeare wrote, and as Beethoven played music. You do the very best you can, and you will be successful.
I'd like to ask you about the latest Stand Your Ground case in Florida, the Jordan Davis case, the so-called loud music case. Michael Dunn was convicted of attempted murder charges, for which he'll serve at least 20 years behind bars. But the jury was unable to reach a verdict on a first-degree murder charge. Do you think he should be retried for murder?
Yes, I believe that even though he's off the streets, Michael Dunn, like George Zimmerman, was allowed to escape from our criminal justice system and escape criminal liability for killing Jordan Davis. And George Zimmerman was allowed to escape criminal liability for killing Trayvon Martin. And that is very troubling. It sends a very troubling message to society, just an irresponsible message. It says that as long as you miss, because when you think about Jordan Davis' case, he got convicted for the attempted murders. And Marissa Alexander, an African-American female who shot a warning shot against her domestic violent husband, who said on the record, in deposition, that he beats all his women. She shot a warning shot in the air, and she was convicted for 20 years, Scott. So what message are we telling society? That when you go to shoot, you make sure you shoot to kill, because if you shoot to kill, there's a good chance that your stand your ground argument is going to work out a whole lot better than when you miss. If you miss, you go to jail. But if you kill the young black person, then you can play this whole argument that Zimmerman played, that Michael Dunn played, which is, oh, it was a black male. They were suspicious. I feared for my life. I was standing my ground. And then when you go to court, attack the character of the black person because you say, you know, they're all thugs. You know, they're all criminals. And unfortunately, society is accepting these arguments. How do we know? Look at the trial from Trayvon Martin. You look at the trial from Jordan Davis. So that's the playbook they're using. And so at Cooley Law School, law students around America, we got to figure out better how to make America understand that all young black men are not criminals. All young black men are not thugs. And in fact, the majority of us are good, decent people who want the American dream, just like your children want the American dream.
Benjamin Crump speaks in the lobby of Cooley Law School from 6 to 8 p.m. in downtown Lansing. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. This is Current State. The 1491s describe themselves as a gaggle of Indians chock full of cynicism and splashed with a good dose of indigenous satire. The five Native American artists create work that will make you snicker, but also make you think. Videos on their YouTube channel range from physical and satirical comedy about Indian authenticity to spoken word poems about the abuse of Native women. I spoke with Bobby Wilson and Dallas Goldtooth of the 1941s earlier this week. I asked them how the group came together, as many of the members reside in different states. But Bobby and Dallas had different stories about their origins. Dallas Goldtooth offered his version of their creation first.
Well, the short and skinny of it is that we all happened to be in the same place at the same time in Minneapolis and kind of knew each other in a general way and decided that we wanted to make a parody video. And so that's my version of it.
All right,
that's
Bobby.
Probably the best I've ever heard you explain it, actually. Everybody else you ask, even me, I'm like, well, Dallas and his brother, Miggy Z, they're brothers. They don't look like each other, but that's because they're stepbrothers. And then...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's usually what...
and then it goes on.
It devolves down to, well...
Yeah. Together. A couple times and...
I want to talk about one of the first videos that you made, the New Moon Wolfpack Auditions. And for listeners out there who don't know what that is a movie in the Twilight series, New Moon.
Who doesn't know?
I don't know. There are people out there.
I feel like, all right. Well, that was, I guess, one of the first videos that we put out. And honestly, it wasn't really, we didn't think too deep about it. It was just an idea that we thought was funny in the moment. The movie New Moon had just dropped. It just came out. And the big hoopla was, you know, the wolves, the Indian transforming shapeshifter hotbod wolves. And we thought that was just a prime, I don't know, what is it, target, prime target to parody as Indian men who do not have those type of bodies. Except Bobby. Bobby does have
for sure
a 12-pack stomach.
It's in there. Yeah. It's buried in there.
See, I do, but it's hidden. It's just potential. Yeah. I have a whole lot of potential. Yeah.
I want to play a clip from that video. This is after the casting director has asked you to show him your Indian stuff, as he phrases it. And you guys danced around screaming, half-dressed, and now you're doing your individual auditions.
Before we start, may I ask, you turn that off? Because in our way, that thing you have there, that machine, may take my soul.
No, we can't, because this is an audition.
I get mistaken on the street a lot for a jaguar paw from Apocalyptico. You know, that movie.
But it may take my soul, and I do not want that. I can never go back to my people.
You won't get the part if we got to turn this off, because we have to show the director this.
Film away.
Okay.
That video, there's so many things going on. You're critiquing Hollywood, not employing tribal actors, and there's also issues of authenticity addressed. Why use humor to get at these serious things?
It's probably the best way to really address it. How do I articulate that, really? I mean, if you got to explain the joke, it isn't funny, right?
Yeah.
But I once heard Dallas say that Richard Pryor once said that humor comes from a dark place.
Did I say that?
You said that. Richard Pryor said that.
Well, gosh darn it, that's a good gem of truth, isn't it?
Yeah, sure is, you know? If you're not laughing, you're crying. Somebody else told me that.
We're just going. Yeah. I'm just thinking back all the wooden plaques on my mom's wall. Yeah. Well, if they, yeah. He who hoots with the owls at
Indian
night
wisdoms.
Cannot soar with the eagles in the morning.
Yeah.
No, I did hear that. Is that a lot of comedy comes from a dark place. Some of the greatest comedians that you see out there, may not necessarily be the subject, but their background, where they come from, it's also could be seen as a way of coping. Or the way I like to see it is a prime target in a lot of our comedy is Indian men, you know, us, or we as Native men. And I like to see on an intellectual level, it's a means of us kind of coming to grips with all that crap that we've been taught about how to be and just kind of regurgitating that out. You know, it's a means for me, I guess, to process what it means to be a Native man and just have fun with that, you know, and be highlight it in its own dysfunctionality.
That sounds
right. I'm okay
right.
with that. Yeah.
Are you okay
he
with
went
that?
To Berkeley,
okay.
just
Thank
so you
Thank
know.
You. Thank you.
When it comes to this kind of humor, I think that I really like to make fun of stuff that I hate and that I am sort of afraid of. And I think that that helps kind of deal with personal issues mm-hmm. on a number of levels. And to be able to make fun of things that have a deep effect and impact on the Indian community that we've grown up in gives us a little more power to do away with it rather than to complain about it.
It's taking control in
yeah.
a sense.
Yeah.
You guys are clearly funny. But when did you realize that, you know, these funny videos that you were posting were actually reaching people and having an impact?
I realized almost right away because I think it was the day after I got done with these guys hanging out and making that video. I was teaching art classes for a week in St. Francis, South Dakota. And some of the kids had remembered me because I'd been going every year for the past couple of years before that. And that video came out, I think, my third day that I was there. And literally the next day, all those kids had already seen that video. I didn't show them that video. They're just like, hey, I just
You're
saw you. And they're all trying to hack into their blocked YouTube pages on their school's network.
Yeah.
So right away, I was like, dang, man, like we just made that. And I didn't even know that it was online yet.
I think I was in denial for a long time. But I don't know. There was never a single moment, but I think one moment that stands out is there's this powwow called Gathering of Nations. It's the largest powwow in North America. I mean, they have like, you know, 50,000 people show up. It's in New Mexico. And at the powwow, I sit down and out of nowhere, the powwow MC, who's the MC for the entire event, calls me out and says, Dallas Goldtooth, are you here? Come on up. Yeah. And he did that because I did a video parodying him and doing his voice. And so he tried calling me out. I never went up. I got scared. I went to the porta potty and sat there and cried for about half hour. How does he know me?
It's true.
Yeah.
Everybody was texting you.
Yeah. So that was a moment that stands out in my mind.
At the core, I think of all of your projects after watching a lot of your videos is this idea of being your own storytellers. And that's something that you're also encouraging others to do with Represent. Talk a little bit about that.
The Represent series is a series that we did.
We continue to do.
We continue. It's an ongoing project of ours. And I mean, the purpose of it is that it speaks for itself. And so, you know, I can only say so much, but really the power and the impact comes from you watching it. And so if you're listening, go to YouTube and type in Represent 1491s and see the number of videos. I think we have like 40 or 30 videos out or whatever. It's of sorts speaking out, but also speaking in to ourselves of reaffirming our existence as Native people today, in the moment, as we are in all its beautiful complexity. You know, whether you're an iron worker working on the buildings or whether you're a casino floor manager or whether you're a student, all those different things, we really want to just highlight the complexity and the diversity amongst Native people today. Because in the college classes, in the high school classes, in the TV, the dominant narrative about Native people is always exists within a space of yesterday, of the past. You know, that's all you get. So we want to kind of challenge that in our way.
What do you guys have in mind for the future? I mean, your YouTube channel is really successful. You guys are doing a lot of speaking engagements. Bobby, what's next?
We'll probably just keep doing this until we're like 50. Yeah. And everybody will go, hey, Wolfpack.
Me. Come here. We're going to... The next...
Okay, we just got off of a one-week retreat. As a group, last year, we had our first annual retreat, which produced several videos and also an outline for what type of full-length movie we would like to make. So we, this year, had our retreat in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, and spent a little time in Tulsa outlining and planning what this feature-length movie is going to look like. And we also filmed several videos, some of which have been released, some of which are being edited. I don't know what the plan really is, if there is a plan, but it's really just to keep on enjoying what we do. Because if we stop having a good time, then what's the point?
There are a lot of people out there who would consider themselves to be allies of the Native American community. But sometimes in doing that, they end up being exploitive. What is the best way to act or to be an advocate for the Native American community?
Damn, she dropped the heavy one.
I'm sorry
one.
I got so serious at Damn. The end here.
Hate that question.
The weights are hitting, weighing me down right now. I can't do it, brother.
There is no real way, unless they want to do the go back to Europe movement. They're starting one, I've heard.
I guess they're building boats now. Yeah,
they're starting to build boats.
And Norway is opening up a process where you can go back to Norway. And just a little thing to think about is, man, like most impacted communities, ethnic communities, I mean, we got a lot of crap we're dealing with on our own. A lot of stuff that within ourselves. And so it just takes away so much energy and time trying to explain stuff to you, you know, trying to like break it down for you and help you understand, to be more compassionate, helping you. And if you realize that's just another way of exploitation, is that you're taking time that we could be doing, helping our own people, teaching you. And that, I'm just like, you know, there's a part they have to be educated. You know, of course, you got to educate yourself, but
call people out,
call your own folks out and keep them in check. And that was one of the best ways, you know. If you see somebody really like, hey, man, I'm going to the sweat lodge and like, it's so awesome, you should come to it. You should be like, no, dude, that's not our way, man. Just chill out on that. Put away the sandalwood incense. Put it away.
Dallas Goldtooth and Bobby Wilson are members of the Native American Artist Collective, the 1491s. And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, the lovely Sue Carter will be hosting. We'll preview Tigers baseball with Dan Dickerson, and our Neighbors in Action segment will feature the Conflict Resolution Center. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery, and also Aaron Young for engineering, and Hannah Michaeljohn for production assistance. I'm Emmanuel Berry. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Thank you.